Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And so in an era of making factories efficient and conveyor belts and streamlining production processes, there's a kind of streamlining of the American diet that takes place.
Abigail Carroll explores how our meal structure has changed over the years and why there's a moral undertone in many conversations we have about breakfast. There's no question Daniel Orr's buttermilk biscuits are the best you'll ever have. It's actually an old family recipe. Then a savory pie with Swiss chard and Parmesan cheese. From Harvest Public Media today, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and what it could mean for exporting GMOs. And you can borrow my tractor if I can borrow your combine. We hear about a network that connects farmers who need equipment. Some news stories we've been following. Here's Mark Chilla.
Proponents for mandatory labeling of genetically modified ingredients just gained a major ally. Campbell Soup Company announced on January 7th that it supported mandatory GMO labeling on food. The company said it believes it's necessary for the government to provide a national standard for consumers, and it would support federal legislation. Campbell announced it would no longer take part in any group that opposes mandatory GMO labeling, but it would continue to oppose state-based measures, arguing it creates unnecessary confusion for customers. Groups such as the Environmental Working Group and U.S. Right to Know have cheered Campbell's decision. The number of acres farmers used to grow crops plummeted in 2015. It was the biggest year-to-year drop in almost 30 years. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has more.
Farmers throughout the country's Midwestern corn and wheat belt had to contend with an extremely wet planting season in 2015. And U.S. Department of Agriculture statistician Lance Honig says with depressed crop prices, it was a tough year for some growers.
More production is always better than less production from an economic health standpoint if you're a producer.
The acreage drop is another marker that recent high times on the farm are likely over. Massive surpluses of corn and soybeans caused prices to drop. The prospect of a global downturn has slowed exports. And that means farmers don't have the incentive to plant all their fields. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
And since December 1st, a new regulation in New York requires chain restaurants to display a symbol, a salt shaker inside of a triangle, on menu items that contain more than the recommended federal daily limit on sodium. The city's Board of Health says the labels will save lives amid an epidemic of heart attacks and stroke for New Yorkers. Cardiovascular disease is a leading cause of death in the city, accounting for 17,000 deaths in 2013. A 2010 study showed that New Yorkers consume an average of over 3,200 milligrams of sodium every day, well beyond the recommended threshold of 2,300. The health department says daily salt intake is even higher among Hispanics and African Americans. The label's main opponent, the National Restaurant Association, says the rule impinges on a restaurant's free speech by forcing them to display the information. This defense is the basis of many arguments against labeling movements across the country. The city's health department responded to a lawsuit from the Restaurant Association, with Health Commissioner Mary Bassett saying in a release that the department is, quote, disappointed that the National Restaurant Association would want to prevent New Yorkers from receiving this important health warning, unquote. A judge is slated to consider the case on January 19th. The decision could quash other health label moves in the city. New York has been a leader in pushing calorie counts, a ban on trans fats, and other public health legislation, which have served as models for similar efforts around the country. Read more about these stories at eartheats.org. And if there are food stories on your radar that you'd like our bloggers to look into, then let us know on Twitter. You can find us at EarthEats.
Liz Leslie and Chad Bouchard write the news stories, and Mark Chilla reads them every week.
Yep. Till next time.
After 7 years of talks, negotiators from a dozen countries along the Pacific Ocean reached a deal to create the biggest trade pact in history. One thing you may not know, a section of the agreement could require some countries to accept more genetically engineered crops. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports.
They're called the sanitary and phytosanitary standards, safety measures a country puts in place to protect its shores. Officials can stop a shipping container right there at the port if they suspect pests, bacteria, or an unapproved product. Floyd Gabler, director of trade policy for the U.S. Grains Council, says that's all well and good, but
the issue really becomes, you know, is when a country's measures step outside of science, that's when we start having incidents that slow down for us the grain importing process and adds time and cost.
Even though many countries have free trade agreements, regulators in the past have been accused of using so-called health concerns as trade barriers to protect domestic markets. That can grind international agreements to a halt and throw off markets. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, creates a process to iron out those disputes. That's big news for Midwest farmers. More than 90% of corn and soybeans grown here are genetically engineered to withstand herbicides or diseases. But some countries have blocked the importation of some of these crops, often called GMOs.
In fact, in the TPP, we actually have language that addresses biotechnology for the first time.
European guidelines contend GMOs have to be proven safe before being accepted in trade. U.S. rules, on the other hand, tend to mark genetically modified products as safe until there is evidence they're not. Countries that sign on to the TPP will follow the U.S. standard. Chip Bowling, president of the National Corn Growers Association, says after years of GMO trade setbacks, it's time other countries fall in line with the U.S. approach. Here's Bowling at a recent press conference.
We know that our product is safe. We need other countries to understand that that's the same thing. The product is safe, and we need to feed a growing world with billions of people coming on board.
Farmers are particularly excited about getting their crops to countries with growing middle-class income, such as Vietnam and Malaysia. But clearly not everyone in the TPP countries is on board with opening the trade gates to GMOs. Just turn on the TV. Last year, demonstrators in countries across the world, including TPP member Japan, protested the approval of genetically modified food. Patrick Woodall is the research director for the environmental group Food and Water Watch.
That's really what the tension is. The TPP is a weapon that enables U.S. agribusinesses to impose its will on other countries.
Under the TPP, Woodall says it would be harder for countries to prevent GMOs from entering their markets if they're already approved in the U.S.
It would press countries to approve GMO crops, to move towards GMO cultivation, even when their domestic people did not want to do that.
The nations signed on to the TPP hold 40% of the global economy. Philip Levy with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs says it's likely more countries will want to sign on after it's approved. He says they are thinking,
these seem to be the new global standards. Life will be easiest for us commercially if we adapt to those standards.
So will global trade be governed by U.S. GMO rules?
That's part of the hope, is that the U.S. has wanted to craft standards that work in its interests.
Congress has yet to approve the TPP, but it's slated to look at the trade deal in the coming months. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up, equipment is a big expense for farmers, and in a down economy, new investment can be out of reach. So, it's time to share. The food Abigail Carroll eats for breakfast is a little unorthodox. On the day I chatted with her, she had ground grass-fed beef with tomato puree and sautéed Swiss chard and onions, leftovers from dinner the night before.
Which is very colonial of me, I must admit.
And she should know, she wrote the book Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. It talks about how eating in America has evolved with the invention of cereals and on-the-go snacking and the idealized family dinner. The cover depicts the many dishes of breakfast. Eggs and bacon, a bowl of cereal, toast, coffee. She says breakfast holds a unique place in the discourse about the American meal structure.
What I love about breakfast and find quite fascinating about it is
the way that people talk about it in moralistic terms. You should and you shouldn't eat it in certain ways or have certain things for it or eat it at certain times, you know, or just the fact that you should eat it. I mean, there's that whole debate of whether you even should eat breakfast. And you don't see that around the other meals as you do around breakfast.
But it wasn't always that way. In the 1600s and 1700s, breakfast foods as we know them today just didn't exist.
People were eating like I had for my breakfast. They were eating leftovers for breakfast, or they might have cornmeal mush. They might have bread and cheese or bread and butter, a slice of pie.
Fast forward to the mid-1800s, Americans were suffering from a collective bout of indigestion. Food reformers started to promote a new idea of breakfast. Eat less, eat lighter.
And they were all about health food. And their number one health food was what they called Graham flour, which was flour that still had the bran in it because it was starting to be processed out of flour and therefore of bread. And so this sort of panacea for all digestive problems becomes the star of the new breakfast. And so that's kind of when the debate starts. You know, that's when people started to talk about breakfast in terms of shoulds and shouldn'ts.
Graham flour was invented by Sylvester Graham, who also preached vegetarianism. John Harvey Kellogg, of course, helped bring cold breakfast cereals onto American tables. Between those two inventors was Henry Crowell, the founder of Quaker Oats.
You know, Quaker Oats was the first packaged breakfast food before breakfast cereals. And oats, of course, are a lot like breakfast cereal. They're just a different way to do cereal. They're eaten hot rather than cold. But they also sort of fit into the new breakfast ideal of the mid to late 19th century because it was, you know, light. But hot cereal goes back a long ways. You know, you see people stirring grains in pots with water, you know, in Britain, and it's very much a peasant food. And if they didn't have, you know, barley to do that with or oats, you know, they would do it with beans or peas. And you have your peas porridge, which is just a different version of that. And people didn't think of it as a breakfast food. They might have eaten it in the morning. They might have eaten it in the evening for supper. It could be a snack. It was a hasty pudding, which meant that it didn't take terribly long to make. Of course, it took less time to make breakfast cereal, you know, cold breakfast cereal. And so that was one of the advantages that breakfast cereal had over oats.
In addition to being the first packaged breakfast food, Quaker Oats had a reputation for purity, thanks in part to the logo featuring the Quaker Man. And purity was important to consumers at the turn of the 20th century.
Food was being sold in bulk for the most part. So if you were going to buy oats, you would go to the store or you could go to your grocer or, you know, you would buy the grains and many other ingredients out of barrels. And there was exposure to air, dust, contaminants, germs, smells, all sorts of things. And not to mention the food could be sitting there for a long time. Well, with packaging, that changed. Packaging ensured that it arrived to the consumer pretty much untouched, especially if it was manufactured by machinery. And so there was a purity associated with that, and people were very interested in purity.
Carol says there are a number of reasons why breakfast evolved from heavy and meat-centered to light and grain-centered. Consumers wanted purity in their food. She talked about the health and nutrition concerns. Of course, there's always taste to take into account. But all these factors, she says, get trumped by work.
Because if they were going to eat a farmer's breakfast and then head to work and sit at a desk, they were not necessarily going to be very productive and efficient. And so the lighter breakfast is an example of a new emphasis on efficiency. And we see that at lunch too. And that's one of the reasons dinner shifts to the evening, because you can't, you know, have that main hot meal of the day in the middle of the day and then go back and sit at your desk for the rest of the day. It just doesn't work out as well. And so in an era of making factories efficient and conveyor belts and streamlining production processes, there's a kind of streamlining of the American diet that takes place. And it's just one more example of how closely the shape of the meal is tied in with the shape of culture and specifically our work culture.
Carol says we've been debating the ins and outs of our first meal of the day for hundreds of years, and how we eat breakfast now is just the latest chapter in that ongoing debate. Her book is Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. She came into the Earth Eats studios last spring. In the second half today, a basic bechamel sauce with Daniel Orr.
It's a quarter cup of butter, a quarter cup of flour. You cook those down to make a roux, and then you add 3 cups of milk to that, and you cook that for about 10 to 15 minutes, and that's your white sauce.
And from here, you can do any number of things. That's where the Swiss chard comes in. I'm sure Abigail Carroll would approve. Hear the recipe coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats, welcome back. I'm Annie Corrigan. We're talking about breakfast, so it got me thinking about some of our go-to morning recipes, like this one from the Earth Eats Wayback Machine.
A lot of people get nervous whenever they bake, especially yeast breads and raised rolls, but you got to start somewhere, and why not with biscuits or pancakes? I'm going to show you the recipe for my grandma's buttermilk biscuits. It's a fourth generation recipe that's been in my family in southern Indiana. We used to feed the farmhands that when they come in from the fields. Now you better hold it just for the weekends and enjoy them once a month. So the flour is chilled. I've got these nice pea-sized pieces of butter. Sometimes I even put them in the freezer just to make sure they're really nice and ice cold. Okay, we're going to add our salt, baking soda, baking powder, and sugar. And the recipe is as simple as that. Now what we're going to do is just kind of mix all those ingredients together. And then I'm going to take my biscuit cutter and just start cutting up those pieces of butter until it becomes almost like a coarse cornmeal. And the reason you want the butter coarse is it's actually going to melt and steam, and that's going to give some part of your rise to your biscuits, so they're nice, light, and fluffy. So once we have this fairly coarsely cut up, and there's still some nice big chunks of butter in there, we're going to add our buttermilk. If you don't have buttermilk, you can take regular milk and just add about a tablespoon of vinegar per cup, and that will instantly turn your milk into buttermilk. I'm going to add about 3/4 of the milk in, and then I'm just going to kind of toss the mixture together, and you're just going to mix it enough to bring the dough together. You don't want to overmix it. You don't want to heat the dough up. Okay, and that's about a perfect dough. You can see the butter chunks still inside. You haven't overworked it. We're going to put it down on the counter with a little bit of flour. Pat it out till it's about the same thickness as your dough cutter. You don't want to twist your cutter, because what that will do is it will break up your little layers of butter that we spoke about earlier. So when you look at the biscuit, you should see those nice layers of butter on the inside. And then what you always want to do is to make sure at the end you have some scraps like this. And those you just kind of break up and you cook those on the side, and those are for the cook. And then we'll have some wonderful biscuits to have our apple butter on. All right, and there they are. Aren't they beautiful?
You'll see these biscuits popping up on any number of dishes Daniel Orr prepares for Earth Eats. This, in fact, was one of the very first ones he baked for us back in 2010. Keep your oven on. We're going to put something savory in to bake. A gratin is a creamy baked dish, usually with cheese. Parmesan cheese, in this case, and lots of it. That comes a little bit later in the recipe. Daniel has 8 local eggs on the ingredients list, along with some beautiful Swiss chard, leaves, stems, and all.
You know, usually they think, oh, we'll just cook it down like greens. But it's a very different type of vegetable because it has this really colorful, especially the rainbow Swiss chard, has a really colorful stems. And it's funny because here in America, a lot of people eat the leaves and they throw away the stems, where in Europe, they eat the stems and throw away the leaves. So it's just, you know, a different continent, different concept.
When he originally wrote this recipe, it only included the stems because he was working in Europe at the time. He changed it, so now both the stems and the leaves got tossed in. Take a listen.
So I'm just going to cut the stems into about 1/4-inch pieces. Okay, we're going to rough chop the greens. All right, I'm just going to take these over to some salted boiling water. I'm going to blanch them, cook them till they are a little bit tender, and then shock them under cold water, and then squeeze them out, and then I'll bring them back to the prep table.
Okay, we'll revisit the kitchen after another story from Harvest Public Media. After land, equipment is typically the biggest expense for Midwestern crop farmers. When times are good, people buy new, bigger, or fancier tractors and combines. But in a down economy like the current one, new investments are almost impossible. Enter the sharing economy. Amy Mayer reports.
On a windy day during the massive harvest last fall, the parking lot outside Key Cooperative here in Roland, Iowa, received load after load of corn. There was no other place to put it. But on the other side of the building, giant pieces of equipment sat idle.
I'll let you in. You can sit in the driver's seat.
It's quiet high above the ground in the cab of this floater, a fertilizer spreader with giant tires that help prevent the soil from getting compacted. Key Co-op's Boyd Brody says they maintain a fleet of equipment that's available for area farmers when they need it.
We're buying very expensive equipment, you know, $300,000-$400,000, you know, purchase price. And our seasonal nature of the business when we're growing crops, we can a lot of times only operate that equipment for weeks or maybe a month or more.
It's tough for a business, whether an equipment dealer, a co-op, or a family farm, to see an asset sitting unused.
Well, we've just shared a few items, and we just put them out so we could see again how they appeared on the site. And
Brody's looking at Key's listings on a new online platform meant to tackle that very problem, machinerylink.com. It's kind of like the popular housing site Airbnb. You've got something you're not using all the time, so you make it available for someone who only needs it for a few days or weeks. Instead of a guest room or in-law apartment, we're talking about planters, combines, tractors.
The sharing opportunity is one way, I think, that we can reduce our costs, be more efficient, and actually try to get to a break-even or some level of profit.
Machinery Link Sharing launched last fall, and the timing may be perfect. Prices for the Midwest's biggest crops have plunged, and that's hurting everyone in farm country.
You get innovative when things get tighter.
That's Iowa State University agriculture economist Chad Hart.
We're looking for ways to enhance income right now, especially in a low-margin environment.
Modern farmers rely on big-ticket machinery exactly when they need it. Your next-door neighbor probably needs the harvester at the same time you do. So an online platform expands the pool and can match up users farther afield. It's kind of like a dating site. Indeed, Machinery Link has borrowed from various Silicon Valley success stories to bring the sharing economy to agriculture, using community rules and a rating system, for example, to hold people accountable. Still, farmers have some unique concerns about sending $500,000 pieces of equipment hundreds of miles away from home. Machinery Link's Jeff Dima says the company understands those worries.
They'd want to make sure that their equipment is going to be taken care of, and we know farmers really well, so we've built a model and a platform that kind of accommodates those concerns.
Insurance, repairs, transportation. Dima says they're trying to put farmers at ease with all of it. He says in a best-case scenario, an owner could more than double the time something gets used. A combine, for instance, could start harvesting in Texas in May and travel north with the season. The owners earn rental income all the while, except when they're using it themselves. And Mark Hanna, an Iowa State University agricultural engineer, says there's another way that short-term renting or sharing equipment might help farmers.
It is a great way to test something a little bit before you actually jump in and use it.
Hanna says that something might be the latest piece of technology, but it could also be a farming practice.
You need a certain piece of equipment maybe to do that, but how does that interplay with my fertility, my pest management, that type of thing? So you can see this in practice before you make the big jump in terms of equipment investment.
As the system grows, it's likely to face unique challenges, just as Uber, Airbnb, and other tech ventures have. But as farming gets ever more dependent on new technology, a sharing system could help some farmers stay current or simply in business. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
We posted this story on our website. They've got extra interviews, blog posts, and news stories over at harvestpublicmedia.org.
All right, we're back at the prep table. Got this beautifully blanched chard. Okay, we're going to start adding our other ingredients. And so we're going to add some bacon. Now, if you're vegetarian, probably want to leave that out.
It's good advice.
Okay, we add some lemon zest. Lemon zest gives you that nice citrusy pop, that wonderful kind of aromatic flavor of the lemon, but without the acidity of the juice. Okay, we're going to add some thyme leaves, fresh thyme leaves. Okay, then we've got some eggs. Stir that up. Get those eggs all broken in there. The next ingredient is going to be bechamel sauce. Now, bechamel sauce, it's one of what we call in cooking mother sauce. And the way you remember your mother sauce is there are five mother sauces, and you remember TV and bed. So TV, tomato velouté, bed, bechamel espagnol demi-glaze.
Meaning you just use these all the time?
Yes, they're base sauces, and then lots of sauces are built on top of these. So basically, if you've ever had biscuits and gravy, you've had bechamel sauce. It's a quarter cup of butter, a quarter cup of flour. You cook those down to make a roux, and then you add 3 cups of milk to that, and you cook that for about 10 to 15 minutes, and that's your white sauce. Okay, we're going to add Parmesan cheese. Okay, put this in a nice big baking dish. These are the breadcrumbs that I'm putting on top of the gratin, and then I'm going to top it with a little more cheese, and then we're going to toss that in the oven. It's about 15, 20 minutes, and we've got a wonderful gratin de blette, or Swiss chard gratin.
EarthEats.org to make this dish yourself. It is a goodie. We've got a good group of folks on the Earth Eats squad. It's Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Always a pleasure to spend some time with you. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Annie Corrigan.